Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine, you are about to walk down a dangerous, completely unlit road.
A road that is, you know, known to be frequented by bandits and wild animals.
Exactly. And naturally, you seek out a master to ask for a shield or a weapon or perhaps a magical amulet to guarantee your bodily survival.
Right. You want a barrier.
Yeah, you expect a barrier. But instead, the master looks at you and suggests that the only way to truly survive this road is to realize that the road, the bandit, and the very concept of you do not actually exist.
Which is an incredible premise.
It is. Today, we are opening an ancient text that completely dismantles the human illusion of safety. It's inviting you into a landscape of protection that is radically different from anything we are taught in our modern material lives.
Welcome to this Dharma Discourse, fellow practitioners. We really invite you to settle your mind, to bring your awareness to the present moment.
To just arrive here with us.
Yes, to approach this exploration not merely as an acquisition of historical facts, but as a mirror reflecting the fundamental nature of your own mind. Today, we are turning our attention to a magnificent canonical text.
The Noble Mahayana Sutra, Dispelling the Darkness of the Ten Directions.
That's the one. And to ground us in the lineage of this teaching, it is vital to understand what we are actually holding.
Right. The historical context is so important here.
It is. This is a canonical Tibetan Buddhist text, meticulously preserved in the Dedjikan Yur.
And for those who might not know, the Kangyur is this monumental collection of the translated words of the Buddha.
Exactly. And the specific version we are exploring today has been painstakingly brought into the English language by the scholars at the 84,000 Project.
Which is that incredible global initiative dedicated to translating the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages, right?
Yes, it's a massive undertaking. The historical weight of this transmission carries an immense gravity. When we read these words, we are participating in a continuous stream of wisdom.
A stream stretching back over a millennium.
Precisely. This sutra was translated into Tibetan no later than the early 9th century. It happened at Samye, which was Tibet's very first monastery.
Oh, wow. So it's foundational.
Very much so. It was the collaborative effort of great Indian and Tibetan masters, luminaries like the Indian preceptor Vishuddhasya, the Tibetan translator Bande Tsang Devendrakova, and the renowned chief editor Louis Galtzen.
Just keeping that lineage in our awareness really provides a firm foundation for our discourse today.
I agree. It centers the mind.
So our intention today is to systematically walk through this sacred text. We will examine how a seemingly simple rite of protection, a text historically used as a blessing for travelers, actually functions as a vast, intricate map.
A map of the Mahayana Pass itself.
Right. It requires a complete paradigm shift regarding our understanding of fear, safety, and ultimately awakening itself. But, you know, before we enter the cosmic maps and the descriptions of distant Buddha fields, there is a striking tension in the very premise of this sutra.
The tension between the title and the narrative catalyst is indeed the ideal place to begin our investigation.
Because the title evokes a staggering cosmic scale. Dispelling the darkness of the ten directions, it brings to mind images of galaxies shifting. Right,
it was the entire universe being flooded with an illuminating clarity.
Exactly. Yet the opening narrative that triggers this massive revelation deals with a very mundane, universally recognizable state of mind.
The anxiety of leaving one's house.
Yeah, it is the fear of vulnerability that accompanies travel.
The Dharma is invariably spoken into the reality of human suffering. It does not exist in a void.
It's always grounded in our lived experience.
Precisely. Before we can navigate the cosmos, we must firmly ground ourselves in the historical reality of the Buddha's life and the visceral vulnerabilities that prompt beings to seek his guidance.
So the text sets the scene in the morning. The Blessed One, having put on his lower robe and taking up his alms bowl and his upper Dharma robe, is traveling.
He's walking toward the great city of Kapilavastu to receive alms.
And he is escorted by a great assembly of monks.
I think we should linger on that visual for a moment. We see the Awakened One engaging in the most humble, physically grounded activity imaginable.
Walking the earth to receive food.
Exactly. Kapilavastu, historically, is the city of his youth. It's his childhood home before his renunciation. So there is an unmistakable physical reality here.
You can almost perceive the dust rising from the road, the quality of the morning light, you know?
The sound of the robes moving in the air, yes.
And as this procession moves toward the city, a Shakya youth named Shining Countenance is heading out of Kapilavastu in his chariot. He's setting out to attend to some affairs.
And from a distance, Shining Countenance sees the Buddha approaching.
Right, and his immediate reaction is one of absolute devotion. He dismounts from his chariot, bows with his palms joined, and places his head at the Buddha's feet.
He then circumambulates the Blessed One three times and sits before him with joined palms to make a formal request.
The transition from worldly momentum to sacred stillness is just beautifully illustrated here.
It really is. The chariot represents motion, worldly obligation, and likely a degree of wealth or status. Upon seeing the Buddha, Shining Countenance abruptly halts that worldly trajectory.
Dismounting and lowering himself to the earth is a physical manifestation of relinquishing ego.
And the three circumambulations serve as a traditional mark of supreme veneration. For the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, he is intentionally preparing his mind to become a vessel for the teachings.
But the teaching he requests, it stems from immediate practical anxiety. He articulates two specific worldly fears to the Buddha.
What does he say?
First, he says, "Blessed One, here in this city, both my father and mother, while they are asleep or awake, might be harmed by non-human beings."
So he is gripped by the anxiety of what might happen to his vulnerable parents while he's away.
Exactly. And second, he speaks of his own journey. He says, "Blessed One, I too, when traveling to other lands, might be harmed by bandits or wild animals."
These articulate the absolute foundational fears of human existence.
They really do. It's so relatable.
We fear for the safety of our loved ones when they are outside our sphere of control. And we fear for our own bodily integrity when we step beyond the boundaries of our known environment.
The bandits represent the malice of other human beings, right?
Yes. And the wild animals represent the unpredictable, amoral danger of the natural world, while the non-human beings represent the unseen, psychological, or spiritual forces that afflict us.
Especially in the vulnerability of sleep or darkness.
Precisely.
So, confronted with these threats, Shining Countenance asks for a definitive solution. He pleads, "Therefore, may the blessed, thus gone, worthy, completely perfect Buddha, out of compassion for me and by any means protect me."
He wants to ensure that human and non-human beings and those in the animal realm do not harm him.
Yeah, he literally says, "Please teach a rite of protection."
To understand the function of this text, we must recognize its historical usage. For centuries, this very sutra has been utilized exactly as Shining Countenance requested.
As a blessing for travelers.
Right. Practitioners traditionally chant it at the beginning of undertakings, or carry it among their possessions when embarking on a journey to invoke the blessings of the Buddhas and clear away obstacles.
It speaks to a very real lived necessity, which brings us to a critical juncture regarding how we conceptualize spiritual practice.
How so?
Well, many of us operate with an expectation that spiritual devotion functions somewhat like an insurance policy. We offer a prayer, chant a text, or perform a ritual, and in return, we expect a guarantee.
A guarantee that our physical bodies and material possessions will remain completely unharmed.
Exactly. We desire a spiritual force field. If the Buddha were to simply offer Shining Countenance an amulet and say, "Keep this in your pocket and the bandits will not see you," he would be validating a delusion.
He would be validating that the external world is the primary source of danger, and that physical preservation is the ultimate goal of existence.
Right. He would be operating strictly within the realm of worldly magic.
Which only addresses the symptom. The Buddha, acting as the supreme physician of the mind, targets the underlying disease.
The root of Shining Countenance is terror.
Yes. Because the root is not the bandit or the wild animal. The root is ignorance and the grasping, clinging to the self.
And so the Blessed One's response is just this absolute masterclass in shifting the practitioner's paradigm. He tells Shining Countenance to listen carefully and keep his instructions in mind.
He does not offer a physical talisman.
No, not at all. Instead, he radically expands the youth's map of reality. He takes him on a journey through the cosmos, starting with the four cardinal directions.
And for each direction, the Buddha describes a specific world system, names a resident Buddha, establishes a distance, and sets a condition.
Crucially, a highly specific mental condition the traveler must meet to ensure their safety.
As we navigate these directions, we must pay close attention to that psychological shift required at each point on the compass.
The Buddha is indeed offering a map, but the terrain it charts is the internal landscape of the mind.
Let's begin with the east.
Okay, the instruction begins with the east. The Buddha states that in the eastern direction, 80,000 Buddha fields beyond our own, there is a world system known as Shaking All Defilements.
And in that realm resides a Buddha known as Follower.
Right. The Buddha instructs Shining Countenance that when he sets out to the East, he must pay homage to this Buddha, bring him clearly to mind, and if he departs with this clear mind, he will have no fear.
The nomenclature used here is highly intentional. The world system is named Shaking All Defilements. In the Tibetan translation, the term for defilement is Zagpa.
Zagpa. Could you define that for us?
Of course. To grasp the depth of this instruction, we must examine what Zagpa truly signifies. Defilements are the mental impurities, the afflictive emotions, the ingrained habitual patterns.
The things that obscure the natural, luminous clarity of our minds?
Exactly. They are the mechanisms of grasping, aversion, and ignorance that continuously leak our vital energy into the cycle of samsara.
So a world that is shaking all defilements is, therefore, a state of being where these impurities are actively being dismantled and cast off.
Right. And the Buddha speaks a verse to solidify this practice. He says, "Thoroughly honoring the Lord, the completely perfect Buddha, the great sage."
If you maintain this clearly and then depart, you will have no fear.
The protection arises directly from the clarity of honoring the awakened state. When the practitioner's mind is thoroughly concentrated on the pure qualities of an awakened being, the mental bandwidth is entirely occupied.
It's occupied by that luminosity.
Yes. There is simply no space for the defilement of anxiety to take root. The mind is fortified not by a defensive wall, but by its own unwavering focus on purity.
That's a beautiful way to phrase it. So if the East establishes a mind clear of defilements, the South addresses the mechanics of attachment.
Yes, moving to the South.
The Buddha describes a world system 90,000 Buddha fields to the south called Dispelling the Mass of Dense Darkness, and the Buddha residing there bears a remarkably descriptive title.
King who is superior due to freedom from fear and timidity in any activity since first generating the mind of awakening.
It's a long title, but it's a teaching in itself.
Right.
Absolutely. It describes a being whose very essence is fearlessness, a courage born at the exact moment they first generated bodhicitta.
The altruistic intention to attain complete awakening for the benefit of all sentient beings.
Yes. It suggests that true altruism is the ultimate antidote to timidity.
And the specific condition the Buddha sets for traveling south requires a radical severing of normal human instincts. He instructs that one must depart undistracted, free of thoughts of home, and so forth.
The accompanying verse reinforces this. Freed from obsession with thoughts of home, when you travel south, you will experience no fear.
This psychological insight here is just staggering to me. Why does travel induce fear?
Frequently is because we are mentally tethering ourselves to the perceived safety of what we've left behind.
Right. We obsess over the comfort, the familiarity, and the physical walls of our home.
This attachment creates a psychological stretching, much like a rubber band. The further we physically move away from our origin while continuing to mentally cling to it, the more tension we create.
And that tension is experienced as fear.
Precisely. The Buddha instructs that to be genuinely safe on your journey, you must completely arrive in the reality of the journey itself. You must consciously relinquish the mental grasping at the physical structure of your home.
So, if the South dismantles our attachment to where we came from, the West forces us to confront the reality of where we are standing right now.
It asks us to look at the very nature of the threat itself.
Right. The Buddha states that beyond us in the West, at a distance equal to the grains of sand in the Ganges River, is a world system known as reaching one's goal.
The metric used here, the sands of the Ganges, is a recurring metaphor in Mahayana literature. It is employed to denote a number that is infinitely large.
Stretching our conceptual framework far beyond ordinary mathematics.
Exactly. Forcing the mind to encounter the vastness of the cosmos.
And in this infinite expanse resides the Buddha named Subjugator of Resentment and Conceit. The requirement for traveling west is that one must depart without defilements, undistracted, and with mindfulness.
The verse the Buddha provides for the West shifts the discourse into the absolute core of Mahayana philosophy.
He says, "There are no phenomena that arise, nor are there any that cease. Those who understand phenomena thus have no fear whatsoever."
This verse eloquently articulates the doctrine of shunyata, or emptiness.
Right, and the text explicitly mentions mindfulness, or dranpa in Tibetan.
Yes, dranpa is the indispensable faculty of calm abiding. It's the ability to hold the mind steadily on its object.
And in this instance, the object of mindfulness is the profound realization that phenomena, all things, all events, all bandits, all wild animals, and even the self that is perceiving them, do not possess inherent independent existence.
They do not truly arise from their own side, and consequently, they do not truly cease.
Okay, but if we view this skeptically for a moment, we really have to address the sheer practicality of this instruction.
The lived reality on the road.
Yeah. A charging wild animal or an armed bandit on a lonely road presents a sudden, sharp, undeniable physical reality. If I stand on the road and merely meditate on the fact that the animal lacks inherent existence, my physical body is still highly likely to be destroyed.
This is a very common objection.
How does a practitioner reconcile this vast philosophical emptiness with the brutal reality of physical danger? I mean, is the text suggesting that realizing emptiness acts as an invisible physical shield?
That is the essential question every practitioner must grapple with when confronting the teachings on emptiness. We must distinguish between relative truth and ultimate truth.
Right, the two truths.
Yes. In the realm of relative truth, the charging animal exists, the physical body exists, and the tearing of flesh will cause intense pain. The text is not suggesting that realizing emptiness makes the animal's teeth vanish into thin air.
So what is it addressing?
It is addressing the internal architecture of fear itself. Fear is the psychological anticipation of the loss of the self.
Ah, I see. It requires a solid, independent me being threatened by a solid, independent other.
Exactly. If through rigorous meditative practice, the self is genuinely understood and experienced as a fluid, empty construct, a dependent origination rather than a fixed entity, the psychological suffering associated with the destruction of the physical form is radically diminished.
Or even eradicated.
Yes. The pain may occur, but the terror, the grasping resistance to the pain, does not. Furthermore, from a karmic perspective, the environment is deeply responsive to the mind of the practitioner.
Like the stories in the suttas, right?
Precisely. We see accounts of the Buddha calming a charging elephant, Nalagiri, not through a magical force field, but by radiating boundless loving kindness.
Because loving kindness is the operational output of realizing emptiness.
Exactly. When you deeply realize that you and the animal are not separate, independently existing entities, your mind ceases to project hostility or fear.
And the absence of that energetic frequency of fear often alters the aggressive dynamic of the external threat.
The ultimate armor is to possess no egoic surface that a weapon or a fang can strike.
Wow. That significantly alters the definition of a right of protection. It is the total dissolution of the target.
It truly is. Which leads naturally into the final cardinal direction, the north.
Right. The north completes the horizontal map by addressing how we categorize the beings we encounter. 10 billion Buddha fields away is the world possessing a Buddha's eloquence.
Where the Buddha, overpowering with the light of an array of the reflections of jewels, resides.
The Buddha instructs Shining Countenance to bring this clearly to mind, offering this verse. Always make the mind equal toward all sentient beings. If you do not disrespect any sentient being, you will experience no fear.
The North establishes the practice of perfect equanimity.
Which is incredibly demanding.
To make the mind equal toward all sentient beings is perhaps one of the most difficult practices. It requires the systematic eradication of the biases that instinctively categorize beings into friends, enemies, and indifferent strangers.
Because if you travel with a mind that genuinely respects every living being equally, you are no longer projecting the conceptual label of enemy onto anyone who crosses your path.
And without the internal projection of an enemy, the external fear of an enemy vanishes entirely.
So through these four cardinal directions, the Buddha has constructed a formidable mental architecture. He has instructed the practitioner to abandon mental defilements, to cut the cord of attachment to home, to realize the inherently empty nature of all phenomena, and to cultivate unshakable equanimity.
This is a complete mandala of mental clarity. However, the Mahayana path requires that the mind be fully integrated with the body.
And that the present moment be anchored in historical triumph.
Right. The teaching must expand into the corners of the map.
Exactly. The Buddha now fills in the intermediate directions, linking these profound mental states to specific physical somatic actions and to the historical lineage of awakening.
Let's look at the Northeast.
Okay, in the Northeast, 80,000 fields away is a world called Conquered the Legions of Mara, where the Buddha Maras and doubt, conquered and subdued, resides.
The nomenclature here instantly anchors the practitioner to the most pivotal historical moment in our tradition.
The Buddha Shakyamuni sitting resolute beneath the Bodhi tree.
Yes, on the very threshold of his awakening. The text explicitly recalls this heroic effort, noting how the Buddha ensured that all the gods of the Mara class would not regress from awakening.
The verse for the Northeast reads, "If you travel while keeping in mind the Buddha who defeated the Maras with his very first thought, you will have no fear."
it is crucial to demystify what Amora represents in this context.
Because they're usually depicted as these external demons, right?
Right, while frequently personified in texts and thangkas as demonic external forces attempting to terrify or seduce the meditating Buddha, Maras ultimately represent our own deeply ingrained inner doubts.
Our clinging to the aggregates and the subtlest obstacles to enlightenment.
Exactly. By keeping the Buddha's historical victory over delusion firmly in mind, the practitioner aligns their own perilous journey with the supreme journey of awakening.
You are drawing an energetic strength from the lineage of victory. Your personal fear is subsumed by the historical triumph over all fear.
Perfectly stated.
Moving to the southeast, 20,000 fields away, we find the world ever radiant. It's guided by the Buddha glory of the arising of the irreversible wheel since first generating the mind of awakening.
Here, the text places a heavy emphasis on the six perfections, or the paramitas.
It states this Buddha continually performed acts of generosity, meticulously guarded his moral discipline, assiduously practiced patience, exerted himself in diligence, established deep concentration, and practiced transcendent wisdom.
The six perfections are the operational vehicle of the Bodhisattva path. I want to draw our attention particularly to patience, or kanti in Sanskrit.
Patience is often misunderstood in the West, isn't it?
It is. In a Mahayana context, patience is not merely waiting quietly for a delayed train. It's a profound, active forbearance. It is the capacity to endure the abuse and hostility of sentient beings without generating a flicker of anger.
The endurance required to weather the immense hardships of the Bodhisattva path over countless lifetimes.
Yes. And most fundamentally, it is the cognitive patience required to tolerate the profound, unborn nature of reality. The emptiness we explored in the West.
It requires immense, stable patience to allow your solidified view of reality to dissolve without panicking.
It truly does.
And the condition for traveling to the Southeast involves a highly specific physical action. The Buddha instructs, prostrate with your five limbs and then depart from your home.
The accompanying verse is, prostrate with the five limbs, then depart from home. You will travel without being overpowered by bandits.
So to prostrate with the five limbs means touching your two hands, your two feet, and your forehead to the earth.
It is the ultimate gesture of somatic surrender and veneration.
Think about the mechanics of preparing for an incredibly high-stakes, life-altering event. Initially, your preparation is entirely mental. You run through scenarios in your head. You cultivate a specific attitude.
Which mirrors the mental mapping of the cardinal directions.
Right. But right before you step into the arena, mental preparation alone often feels insufficient. The nervous system requires a physical intervention.
You must ground yourself somatically.
Yeah, you might take a deep diaphragmatic breath, adjust your posture, or consciously feel the weight of your feet on the floor. These intermediate directions, specifically the instruction to prostrate with the five limbs, seem to function as this somatic reset.
The physical ritual locks the mental protection into the nervous system.
The body must actively participate in the relinquishing of the ego, bringing the highest point of the body, the head, down to the dust, physically actualizes the mental surrender.
That alignment of the physical and the psychological is essential. In genuine practice, the mind and body are inextricably linked.
The physical descent to the earth grounds the vast cosmic visualizations we have been building into the literal dirt of the road the traveler is about to walk.
Beautifully put. Now, the remaining intermediate directions continue to weave together physical purity and the act of making offerings.
In the southwest resides the world covered by a golden mat and its Buddha, superior illumination of a jeweled canopy. The physical action required here is to strew some flower petals.
The verse reads, having paid homage to the perfect Buddha, strew some flower petals. When you travel to the southwest, you will not experience fear.
The act of strewing flowers is not merely decorative, is it?
Not at all. It is a physical manifestation of creating a sacred space. It transforms the mundane, threatening road into a mandala of practice.
Psychologically, it shifts the practitioner's mind from a state of anxious hoarding, worrying about bandits stealing their possessions, to a state of pure, unconditional generosity.
You cannot be terrified of losing your wealth while simultaneously intentionally offering beauty to the path.
That's such a profound shift. Then in the northwest, at a vast distance of six Ganges rivers of sand, is the world purified, steadfast, and exalted.
And the resident Buddha is tamer of bodhisattvas.
The text is highly specific about the nature of this world's purity. It states this Buddha field is completely without impurity, without sexual intercourse, without women, without thorns, pebbles, and gravel, and without the five degenerations.
Let's briefly define the five degenerations. This refers to a cosmological dark age, a period characterized by a rapidly decreasing human lifespan, an overwhelming abundance of negative afflictions, degenerate views, a deteriorating physical environment, and a sharp decline in spiritual capacities.
So the realm described in the Northwest is the absolute antithesis of our current degenerate age.
Yes. It is a realm free from the sharp, abrasive edges of worldly existence.
And notice the specific list of what is absent here. A realm without thorns, pebbles, gravel, but also explicitly without sexual intercourse and without women. To a modern listener, this framing naturally stands out.
It absolutely requires contextualization. And we must read it firmly through the lens of its historical and monastic environment.
Right, because the primary audience for many of these early Mahayana discourses were celibate monks.
Monks striving for perfect meditative absorption. The text is effectively externalizing the ideal internal landscape of a monastic practitioner.
In that highly specific context, the presence of anything that might trigger sensory desire or cause physical discomfort is categorized as a friction point.
An obstacle to concentration. Whether it is a sharp stone under bare feet or an object of sexual attraction.
However, the deeper psychological mapping here, which applies to any practitioner today, regardless of gender or monastic vow, concerned our universal desire for a frictionless environment.
Exactly. We constantly attempt to construct ideal realms in our daily lives where our specific personal triggers do not exist.
The profound teaching of this section is found in its condition for travel. How we actually attain that frictionless state.
Right. The condition the Buddha sets reflects that internal shift. He instructs, having first correctly observed pure conduct, depart from home with an undistracted mind.
The verse promises, wherever you travel, you will not be overpowered by bandits.
The sequence of logic is paramount here. The text does not say, find a pure environment, and then your conduct will be pure.
It says, correctly observe pure conduct, and the result is that the environment ceases to overpower you.
The external safety from the bandits is entirely contingent upon the internal behavioral purity of the practitioner. When a practitioner maintains solace ethical conduct, they generate an energetic field around themselves that is fundamentally incompatible with harm.
So the purity is not a geographic destination, it is a behavioral armor.
Exactly.
We have now mapped the four cardinal directions and the four intermediate directions. We possess a complete, flat, two-dimensional map of mental and somatic protection.
But a flat plane leaves the practitioner exposed from above and below.
Right. To seal this protective sphere, the Buddha elevates the discourse to the vertical axis, entirely enveloping the traveler in the ultimate impenetrable armor.
This shift to the vertical axis is where the visualization becomes truly spherical, leaving no vector of vulnerability. It encompasses the practitioner in a boundless field of Mahayana intention.
Let us examine the space above. In the direction of the zenith, at a distance of 60 Ganges rivers, is a world named Possessing Non-Referential Application of Mind.
And the Buddha residing there is the exalted king of meditative concentration, fearless and free from darkness.
The condition for this direction is staggering. Whether sitting or standing, you must pervade all beings with loving kindness.
The verse reads, keeping the mind undistracted, always remember that victorious one. Always develop the mind of loving kindness, and you will not experience fear.
The name of this world system possessing non-referential application of mind is really the key to unlocking this instruction, isn't it?
It is. What does it mean for loving kindness to be non-referential? In our ordinary samsaric lives, our love is almost exclusively referential.
It's transactional and conditional.
Yes. We love a specific person because they validate us or because they belong to our family group. Our love has a defined object, a reference point.
And because it has a target, it inherently has limits. It can be turned off if the object displeases us.
Non-referential loving kindness is a radically different state of being. It is an outpouring of love that radiates outward without requiring a target.
Without categorizing beings into those who are worthy and those who are unworthy.
Exactly. It does not differentiate between the parent you left at home and the bandit approaching you on the road. It is love existing simply as the natural radiance of the awakened mind.
Much like the sun shining into an empty sky, illuminating a flower and a pile of refuse with equal intensity.
That's a perfect analogy.
To hold that state while facing a threat is the ultimate test of the practice. And then the Buddha directs our attention downward.
To the nadir.
Right. In the direction of the nadir, 92,000 Buddha fields away, is the world adorned with all qualities. The Buddha there is named cutting doubt and shaking the defilements since first generating the mind of awakening.
The condition for the space beneath us is the foundational anchor of the entire path. During all activities, day and night, standing, sitting, moving, you must not relinquish the mind of awakening, the bodhicitta.
The verse states, in every activity, day and night, remember that Buddha and do not relinquish the mind of awakening, and you will experience no fear.
By placing bodhicitta, the vow to liberate all sentient beings, beneath the practitioner at the nadir, the text establishes the mind of awakening as the absolute bedrock.
It is the floor upon which the entire mandala is constructed.
If your foundational motivation for taking a single step on the road is the ultimate liberation of all beings, your personal ego-driven fears regarding your own survival lose their ground.
The narrative of me being harmed cannot coexist with the motivation of me liberating all.
Precisely.
When we synthesize the entirety of these instructions, the pedagogical brilliance of the Buddha becomes astoundingly clear. Let's trace the journey we have just taken.
Yes, let's look back at where we started.
We began with shining countenance, standing by his chariot, quite literally asking for a magic spell to prevent his luggage from being stolen and his physical body from being attacked.
And look at the sheer magnitude of what the Buddha has demanded of him in order to secure this protection.
The methodology is flawless. It is the perfection of skillful means, or upaya.
The Buddha meets the terrified student exactly where they are. He takes the raw, mundane fear of physical harm and utilizes it as the very fuel to propel the student into the highest echelons of Mahayana practice.
Because by the time Shining Countenance has fulfilled the requirements for the 10 directions, having completely severed thoughts of his home, realized the empty nature of phenomena, observed perfectly pure ethical conduct, prostrated in total somatic surrender, eradicated the concept of enemies through equanimity, and pervaded the entire universe with non-referential loving kindness rooted in bodhicitta, he is no longer a scared traveler on a dusty road.
He has fundamentally transformed. He has achieved a state of profound, unshakable meditative realization.
The journey across the physical map has become an unavoidable, irreversible journey inward.
And crucially, when this immense internal transformation occurs, the text reveals that it instantly mirrors an external shift in reality itself.
Which brings us to the most staggering cosmic moment in the sutra. When the mind is perfectly protected by these 10 states, the darkness of ordinary samsaric perception completely shatters.
The internal defilements, the zagpa we discussed earlier, are the darkness. When the mind ceases to grasp, the blindfold of ignorance is removed, and the true luminous nature of reality is revealed.
The text describes Shining Countenance speaking up, declaring to the Buddha, "For me, Blessed One, there is no darkness whatsoever in those world systems."
He testifies that he sees those infinitely distant world systems and those 10 specific Buddhas just as clearly and intimately as he sees the Buddha sitting right in front of him.
But it is not just Shining Countenance who experiences this. The text says a great host of beings, 1,000 living beings who had assembled there, all rise up.
They drape their upper robes over one shoulder, kneel on their right knees, and declare the exact same realization. The entire assembly suddenly possesses pure vision.
The magnitude of this visual shift cannot be overstated. The physical limitations of space and distance, the billions of Buddha fields, the distances measured in the sands of the Ganges are completely collapsed.
Ignorance and fear act as a spatial barrier, creating distance between us and the awakened state. When the mind is purified through the systematic practices we just mapped out, that distance evaporates.
The presence of the awakened ones is no longer a distant theoretical concept or a geographical destination. It is an immediate, visceral, visual reality.
The protection is not granted from afar. It is the immediate presence of awakening.
In the midst of this overwhelming visionary experience, the Venerable Shoriputra steps forward from the assembly.
Aputra is historically recognized as the wisest of the Buddha's disciples, the foremost in analytical wisdom.
He asks the vital, grounding question that must be addressed. He asks, Blessed One, what is the merit by which they saw that and by which their eyes were purified? Will there still be fruit when they transmigrate to another life?
Kuriputra is fulfilling a crucial role here. He's demanding the mechanics of cause and effect. He wants to ensure that the assembly and future practitioners understand that this is not a random magical hallucination.
It is the direct logical result of profound merit, of karmic fruition born from apprehending and actualizing these specific teachings.
The Buddha's reply scales up the magnitude of the text even further, moving from the present moment into the vast expanse of future eons.
He prophesies that these 1,000 living beings, due to the root of virtue generated by apprehending the names of these Buddhas and realizing these states, will attain the life of a universal emperor.
As many times as there are grains of sand at the Ganges River, we must carefully define the universal emperor. In Tibetan, the term is Korlos Skewered by Igyal Srid, often translated as a wheel-turning monarch.
In Buddhist cosmology, this represents the absolute highest possible worldly attainment.
It describes a sovereign who rules not through violence or subjugation, but through righteousness, ethical conduct, and the Dharma. A wheel-turning monarch presides over an era of immense peace, prosperity, and spiritual flourishing.
It is the ultimate accumulation of positive worldly karma. But the Buddha makes it clear that ruling the universe thousands of times over is merely the worldly fruit, a byproduct of their realization.
The ultimate prophecy is far more significant.
He states that in their final rebirth, all these beings will perfectly complete the accumulations of merit and wisdom. In a single eon, every one of them will truly and completely awaken to unsurpassed perfect enlightenment.
And remarkably, they will all share the exact same name as a Buddha.
Ornamented with pure eyes.
This confirms that their momentary pure vision on the road outside Kapilavastu was not an anomaly. It was the indestructible seed that will inevitably blossom into their ultimate, complete enlightenment. The trajectory is set.
The reaction of the universe to this prophecy is intensely physical and auditory. The text describes the Trachiliocosm, the vast 3,000-fold world system shaking in six ways.
It quaked. It quaked deeply, and it quaked violently. It shook, shook deeply, and shook violently. It clamored, clamored deeply, and clamored violently.
This specific six-fold shaking is a standard canonical marker found throughout Mahayana Sutras, isn't it?
It is. It indicates a moment of such profound spiritual significance that the physical universe itself must react. It is the fabric of reality vibrating in recognition of beings stepping irreversibly onto the path of complete awakening.
Following the earthquake, a wave of joy cascades upward through the cosmic hierarchy. We hear the voices of the gods.
First, the gods who move directly above the earth cry out in sheer amazement.
Then, hearing their voices, the joy travels upward. It reaches the four great kings, then ascends to the heaven of the 33, the heaven free from strife, the heaven of joy.
Moving up to the heaven of delighting in emanations, it moves through the Maura class, residing in the heaven of making use of others' emanations, up through the Brahma heavens, all the way to the gods of the unexcelled heaven.
They are all overjoyed, exclaiming, "Who would not then develop faith in the Buddha?"
This cascading joy brilliantly illustrates the absolute interconnectedness of all realms of existence, an internal act of pure spiritual realization occurring within the minds of individuals standing on a dusty road sends shockwaves of bliss to the very highest pinnacles of existence.
The liberation of one being is never an isolated event. It is a cause for celebration for all beings across all dimensions.
Truly.
I find myself needing to pause and trace the arc of this escalation. We began this discourse with a young man essentially asking how to avoid physical ruin and financial loss while traveling to the next town.
And we have arrived at a point where the physical universe is violently quaking.
Exactly. And the Buddha is prophesying that this young man and 1,000 others are going to become completely perfect, awakened Buddhas who rule the universe thousands of times over.
The implication seems to be that even the most mundane, fear-based desire for physical safety, if it is brought to the Dharma and placed at the feet of the awakened mind, becomes the very seed of ultimate enlightenment.
It implies precisely that, and this should bring immense comfort to any practitioner.
There is no human anxiety so mundane, so worldly, or so small that it cannot be transmuted by the alchemy of the Dharma. The entry point is irrelevant.
You may come to the teachings because you are terrified of financial ruin, anxious about an illness, or worried about your physical safety on a journey.
What matters is that you bring that raw suffering to the path. If you follow the thread of your worldly fear deeply enough and apply the Buddha's methods of ethical conduct, concentration, equanimity, and the realization of emptiness,
the very map we just traced.
Right. You will inevitably unravel the ego that is generating the terror. You will arrive at awakening. The worldly request is merely the hook. The Dharma provides the liberation.
As the cosmic celebration settles, the narrative shifts toward the future legacy of the teaching. The Buddha turns to his attendant, Ananda, focusing on how practitioners, including those of us engaging with the text today, should carry this discourse forward.
This is the moment where the transmission of the sutra itself becomes the ultimate rite of protection.
The Buddha instructs Ananda that anyone who remembers, upholds, reads, masters, teaches, or even just writes down this Dharma discourse and keeps it with them will be immensely blessed.
He explicitly addresses Shining Countenance's initial fears again. He states that those who uphold the text will not die in a state of distress.
They will not die from the harms of others. They will not experience fear of water, bandits, poison, or weapons.
We have come full circle, but the definition of protection has been entirely rewritten. Having traversed the 10 directions, we understand that the protection promised here is not a magical ward that repels physical objects.
The protection is the internalized realization of the sutra's teachings.
If you hold the truth of emptiness and boundless non-referential loving-kindness firmly within your mind, then even if you are confronted by water, bandits, or poison, your mind will not be overcome by terror.
You will face the dissolution of your physical form without distress, because you profoundly understand the insubstantial, empty nature of what is passing away.
To reinforce this cosmic support, Shakra, the Lord of the Gods, manifests with a retinue of 1,000 gods.
He strews divine Mandarava flowers and sandalwood powder and makes a solemn vow before the assembly.
He pledges to personally protect anyone who upholds the text, whether they are residing in a house, wandering in an empty forest, asleep, or awake.
Shukra's vow represents the unwavering support of the unseen environment. When a practitioner aligns their mind with the profound altruistic truths of the Mahayana, the forces of harmony within the universe naturally align to support and protect their practice.
The Buddha then makes a staggering claim regarding the supreme value of engaging with this text.
He poses a comparison. He says that if someone were to provide a lifetime of the most exquisite robes, alms, accommodations, and medicine to a living physical Buddha, that immense accumulation of merit would not equal the merit of upholding the single Dharma discourse.
Engaging with this text, the Buddha asserts, is a supreme paying of respect, the absolute highest method of venerating the thus gone one.
This requires a profound recalibration of what it means to practice generosity and respect, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. Material offerings, even those made to a living Buddha, operate entirely within the realm of form and worldly merit. They are beautiful, necessary, and generate positive karma, but they do not cut the root of samsara.
Upholding this text means internalizing the wisdom that realizes emptiness.
Right. To realize the true nature of the Buddha's mind is a far greater offering than to merely sustain the Buddha's physical body. You honor the awakened one most supremely by taking up the task of waking up yourself.
This realization leads perfectly into the final, most paradigm-shifting instruction of the entire text.
The alternate titles.
Yes, the Buddha gives Ananda alternative titles for the text, offering different lenses through which to remember it. He says to remember it as dispelling the darkness of the 10 directions.
He also suggests reciting the names of the thus gone ones.
But the final two alternative titles completely deconstruct everything we have just learned: realization of insubstantiality and realization of the lack of characteristics.
We must sit quietly with those last two titles. They are the keys that unlock the ultimate purpose of the sutra.
When I reached this point in the text, it felt like the ground dropped out from under me. Realization of insubstantiality. Lack of characteristics.
It's jarring, isn't it?
It is. The text just spent the better part of an hour providing us with highly specific names, exact distances measured in grains of sand, detailed physical requirements, and the precise characteristics of 10 different Buddhas in 10 distinct world systems.
It built an incredibly elaborate, highly detailed architecture.
But the ultimate realization given in the title itself is that this entire architecture is completely insubstantial. It lacks inherent characteristics.
The detailed map is merely a constructed tool, a raft used to free the mind from its clinging to form. Once you use the map to cross the turbulent river of your own fear, you are required to realize that the map itself is empty.
That is the operational mechanism of skillful means laid bare.
The mind of the fearful traveler, like Shining Countenance, is deeply agitated, desperately grasping at solid forms for safety. If the Buddha immediately spoke of a formless emptiness, the terrified mind would have nothing to hold on to and would panic further.
Therefore, the Buddha gives the mind a sacred, highly structured form to grasp onto, the specific names, the distances, the directional coordinates to stabilize the attention.
But the final destination of that stabilization is the realization that no phenomena whatsoever arise or cease. The practitioner's mind is guided from grasping at worldly forms out of sheer terror, to grasping at sacred forms out of devotion, to finally releasing all grasping entirely into the luminous, boundless expanse of insubstantiality.
That total release of grasping is the true dispelling of darkness.
As we bring this Dharma discourse to a close, let us synthesize the journey we have undertaken together.
What began as a desperate, highly relatable plea for physical protection from bandits and wild animals transformed, layer by layer, into a psychological and spiritual map of the cosmos.
We have seen that true protection is never a magical shield erected against the outside world.
The genuine rite of protection is the rigorous, systematic dismantling of our own internal defilements, our deep-seated attachments to home and self, and our paralyzing fears.
It is achieved not through amulets, but through the maintenance of pure ethical conduct, the profound cognitive understanding of emptiness, and the generation of a boundless, non-referential loving kindness that envelops all beings equally.
When a practitioner today reads, recites, or carries this text, they are not merely holding an ancient historical document translated from Tibetan.
They're holding a mirror directly up to their own boundless potential for awakening.
The darkness that the sutra dispels is not the physical night sky. It is the dense darkness of our own ignorance, the shadows cast by our own grasping ego.
And the light that floods in to replace that darkness is the clear, unobstructed vision of reality exactly as it is. Vast, completely interconnected, and ultimately fundamentally free from any inherent cause for fear.
So we leave you, our fellow practitioner, with a final lingering contemplation based on the wisdom we've explored today. Consider the immediate reality of your own life.
When you leave your house tomorrow, when you begin your commute, or when you face a daunting new undertaking, what specific bandits or darkness are you most terrified of encountering?
What if you were to view those external fears not as threats designed to destroy you, but as profound invitations?
Invitations to step into the center of your own mandala, to consciously pervade all beings with loving kindness.
And to realize that the ultimate indestructible protection is a mind completely free of walls.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.